right. This is it. This is the week you've all been waiting for. We'll see if it lives up to the hype or not. I would say that this is going to be the raciest thing you have ever heard in church before, but a few weeks ago when Eddie was talking about Judah and Tamar and Onan spilling a semen on the ground, maybe not. I don't know. But after Andy's class, though, it did kind of seem like the expectation had been set that we were supposed to provide handouts. And I suggested bringing diagrams, but Glenda said no. All seriousness aside, while these two classes that we're doing will be respectful and not graphic per se, we will be talking about things that I'm sure you have never heard talked about in a church building before. We will be using words that I guarantee you have never heard in a church building before, and maybe have not even been said in your own house to each other. And getting back to Christy's story, maybe that's a little bit of the point of all this. The second thing I want to say is that we are perhaps the last people that should be standing up here giving this class, talking about this subject. As Christy alluded to in her first week in her story about our marriage journey, sex has been a challenge in our marriage. For obvious reasons, I'm not going to be sharing a lot of detail there, but we do want to be a little bit open because we think making it a taboo subject has caused more harm than problems it solved in the name of propriety. And finally, in the way of intro topics, I want to be very clear about something up front. Throughout these two classes, the guys may feel as if I am laying a lot on them. However, as I mentioned, a lot of what I'm going to be talking about is born out of mine and Christy's own story. My eyes have been open to things that I just didn't know, and so maybe, as Maya Angelou said, when you know better, you do better. If sex has been a struggle in your marriage, or if it's been okay, but it feels like it could be better, then that's our hope for you, that your eyes will be open to things you just didn't know. Similarly, I want the women to feel seen. If you resonated with any part of Christy's story, then Christy and I want you to know that we see you. Well, okay, that comes off a bit awkward in this kind of class, but I think you know what I mean. Ultimately, Christy and my prayer for you as we go through these two classes is that it will spark conversation that will only draw you closer together, both physically and emotionally.
So, before we get started, I want to address the scary, sad side of sex and intimacy in our society. I could have looked up a gazillion statistics, but I picked the CDC, and it's found that over half of women and almost one in three men have experienced sexual violence involving physical contact during their lifetimes. We just want to say up front, dealing with sexual assault or abuse is far beyond the scope of this class or probably any book. We encourage you to seek out a good therapist if that's part of your story. Get the help that could make life a whole lot better. Just wanted a disclaimer that we cannot go that far into hour-long classes. So, another thing I want to add to Tim's intro is that we're going to be very vulnerable this week. We talked at length about what we want to cover in these classes and what we're comfortable sharing. We've also talked about how we're taking on a very real risk that everything we say this week and next time is so very basic that you all are going to leave thinking, oh my gosh, I can't believe they didn't know that. How dumb or naive they were. But maybe that'll happen. You know, we are willing to take that risk because maybe someone here in this room or someone who stumbles across the audio recording
or thousands of followers on the pod
will stumble across something they didn't know or some piece of information presented in a way that they hadn't heard before. If sharing our story makes even one person feel less broken or less alone, then it'll be worth the risk we're taking embarrassing ourselves today. So, after all that intro, let's dive in. First of all, I think it's safe to say that almost every couple goes into marriage wanting a good sex life. But when that just doesn't happen the way we've been led to believe it should, we begin to think something's wrong, that it's your partner's fault, that one of you is broken. Surely everyone has this figured out but us. Why isn't this working? And so Tim found a passage, and I agreed to read, and did not mark my paper.
6:25. Mark where it started. You want to figure that out.
Sure. Okay. Do you think there's any hope for us? Francesca's voice breaks as she struggles to get the words out. I love him so much. I can't imagine life without him. But I also can't continue like this. Francesca is one of my oldest and best friends, and her husband Jake is a real gem of a human being, too. They're both warm, generous, intelligent, and regularly bring me to the brink of peeing in my pants from laughing so hard. Their love story is classic. They were set up by a mutual friend, in a land before dating apps, Francesca likes to say, and their marathon blind date at a tiny Italian trattoria only came to an end when the staff politely kicked them out. Francesca and Greg and Jake gracefully slid past every milestone, becoming exclusive, getting engaged, and then married, and having two beautiful and mischievous children. Things seemed beautiful from the outside, but if you looked closely, you could see signs of cracking in the facade. Francesca had a certain way she liked to do things around the house and would get over-the-top irritated at Jake for messing up the pantry organization or folding the towels like a heathen. Jake tended to withdraw, retreating to the basement to watch his beloved Packers and losing himself in long hours at his law firm. The raucous date nights they had once cherished became increasingly infrequent, especially once they became parents. Francesca's and Jake's sex life had grown more complicated, too. At the beginning of their relationship, Francesca and I would spend entire brunches dissecting every last detail of their wildly passionate bedroom escapades. But over time, Francesca's bragging turned into venting. She disclosed that she rarely initiated sex. Even though she considered herself a feminist, she still had the nagging feeling that it should be up to the guy to make it happen. Unbeknownst to Jake, Francesca had been faking orgasms with increasing frequency over the years. Her performance had become half-hearted, and she was growing resentful of him for rolling off her right after having his own climax. Sometimes I don't even bother to fake an orgasm, she tells me, but he still seems to think that once he's done, we're done. Separately, Jake confided in me that Francesca sometimes seemed disinterested and distant during sex, and he would lose his erection in those moments. He'd catch himself feeling anxious the next time they started taking their clothes off, wondering if he was going to be able to stay hard. Their frequency had dropped to maybe a fourth of what it was at the beginning of their relationship, and their satisfaction was at an all-time low. A Category 5 stress hurricane pushed everything to the surface. In a single week, their daughter broke her leg during gymnastics practice, their roof sprung a massive leak, and Jake got passed over for a promotion he'd been gunning for. The tension was palpable for days. By Friday night, Francesca and Jake were looking forward to the moment they could finally relax. After the kids were asleep, they poured glasses of wine, crawled into bed, and turned on a movie. Francesca was just starting to drift off to sleep when Jake started to rub her back. She tensed up immediately. She knew what his massage meant. But couldn't Jake see that his timing was ridiculously bad? Francesca whined, "Jake, I'm exhausted." Jake rolled over onto his own side of the bed, letting out a dramatic sigh. His obvious disappointment set Francesca off in a way she had never before experienced. "How could you be thinking of sex at a time like this?" Francesca snarled at him. "Because I can't even remember the last time we had sex," Jake huffed back. The fight still had Francesca rattled on our walk the next morning. "I don't really know what to do," Francesca said. "I mean, he's right. I can't remember the last time we had sex either." She takes a deep breath, and her voice grows soft and quiet. "It shouldn't be this hard, should it?" "Should we really get into it?" I ask. "Or do you just want to vent?" "I need you in full-blown sex therapist mode," she responds, rubbing at the bags under her eyes. "Help me fix this, please." So that was a segment from a book that was written by not a Christian audience, not from a Christian sex therapist to a Christian audience, but it is a well-known sex therapist.
That said, we highly recommend this book with a significant caveat.
Yeah.
It is because it's not written from a Christian perspective, that brings both good things, we think, and not good things. And so, I think you need a healthy, Christian faith that is well rooted, to read this book. That said, we have found incredible help in this book. So if you're interested, happy to talk more to you about that. All right, so let's start by defining what is sex. And I think if we did a poll, then most of us would probably define that as sex equals penis and vagina intercourse. I was thinking back over my sex ed class back in sixth grade, and yep, that's what I was taught. Even though we don't really talk about sex in church, as Christy mentioned, clearly that's the message that we're getting through messages of frequency, like Nike, just do it, and guys having needs that women will never understand. That's the message we get in TV and movies too, right? A couple comes together in a hot moment, and they start panning, they start to kiss, and then they take off their clothes, and before you can say hot and steamy, they're in bed doing the hokey pokey. And then they both orgasm at the same time. So that seems to be the order, right? Pant, kiss, clothes, bed. And so that becomes our conception of how this actually is supposed to work. After all, that seems hot, right? Seems romantic, right? And so there you are at home, just waiting to start panning, and nothing happens. So you think, I must not be in the mood, and you go back to doing the dishes. But what if you never start panning? You probably start to think, I guess I'm not a sexual person. And over time, maybe you just start to give up. Let me break it to you right now. The whole Hollywood picture is not how it works. And even though we may know that academically, because we've heard that Hollywood's portrayal of sex is wrong, that's still the standard we keep coming back to in our lives. So I want to say that again. Even though we know that academically, that's the standard we keep coming back to in our lives, in our minds. And so let me just tell you, that's a myth. And let's, for the purpose of discussion, let's call that the make-believe sex myth. Okay? And so there lies the problem. We've bought into this make-believe sex myth, even if we know it's not right in our mind, and begin to think there's something wrong with us, either individually or as a couple. We must be the only ones who can't figure this out. If you feel that way this morning, then I want to tell you there is hope. But I also want to tell you that it's a journey, and Christy and I are still on it. There are no quick fixes, but there are things that can begin to make a world of difference. So over the course of these two classes, we want to cover 5 things that will help you build the sex life that you both want. We'll cover just 2 today, so you'll have to come back in 2 weeks to get the other 3. All right? So there's our hook. Be sure not to come back in 2 weeks. You know, however you want to look at it.
Okay. So first of all, our first point is acknowledgement. You've got to acknowledge the elephant in the room. If we go back to our make-believe sex myth, sex just happens. No words. You just look at each other, start panting, and go after it. The myth says you don't have to talk about sex. It just happens. Movies, TV. Christian messaging conditions us to believe that it's a taboo topic, and so many of us keep it as a taboo topic even after we're married. Tim and I never talked about sex. We didn't know how to, and we thought it was just supposed to happen. And after a while of things not working, we were both afraid of talking about it, because we didn't want to start another argument. So if you're like us and afraid to talk about sex, I see you. But avoiding the topic of sex actually creates distance between you. So start small.
Then you just look at each other and say, sex.
That will probably make you laugh, and it will break the ice. Hopefully this class will give you some things to talk about. But if talking about sex produces anxiety in one or both of you, Make a commitment that you'll come to the conversation believing the best of your spouse. Listen and express empathy, trying to listen to what they're trying to say. Try sharing a compliment about your spouse, or about a favorite memory, favorite sexual memory. If face-to-face feels intimidating, send a quick text or email. Share an Instagram reel or a podcast. If past conversations have been tested, try a fresh start conversation to clear the slate, where you acknowledge how you've contributed to the dynamic by not talking about things. Talk about your history and why it's difficult to talk about sex. A couple good conversations where you just listen to understand can help normalize the subject, while also helping you understand your spouse more. I'll also add, talking about sex is easier with time. We obviously talked about sex a lot, getting all these materials together. Tim prepared the materials I read through. We divided it up, all of that. But yesterday, we were out hiking. We went to the marriage retreat in the morning, and then we went hiking. And I was talking about how years ago, I remember being in our counselor's office, and she still reminds me that she was afraid I was going to pass out, because every time the topic of intimacy of sex came up, I would hold my breath so much, she thought I was going to pass out. And then yesterday, we were on the trail, and we were talking about some of the things we'll cover in this lesson about responsive desires versus spontaneous, and whether you need emotional connection to have sex, or sex to have emotional connection, and all of this. And we were making all these hypotheses and wondering if there were studies, and talking back to her. So you know that couple in high school or that girl that we always said this? I wonder if she's this. Or, you know, it was, we went all through all of this, and we were just a couple miles of hiking, and it just became another thing to talk about. So I do want to say, yesterday, while I was out of breath because of elevation, and it was not because I was so buried under my shame that I couldn't take a deep breath.
All right, so First thing was acknowledgement, talking about the elephant in the room. The second topic is intimacy. And the first reference of sex in the Bible is Genesis chapter 4, verse 1. If you read the New Living, it's quite explicit. Now, Adam had sexual relations with his wife Eve. That's probably why the New Living gets a bad rap in church, because you're not supposed to say things like that. Now, let's go back to the Authorized Version, though. The version Jesus used, the King James. And it says, and Adam knew Eve, his wife. And I used to always laugh at that. Haha, they had to change the word because they can't say sex in the Bible. And many of us do think that it's kind of a euphemism, that you couldn't say sex in the olden days, or now for that matter. But there's something more profound here. The Hebrew root word here is the same as David uses in Psalm 139:23. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Clearly, David is not asking God to have sex with his heart. But David is asking God to know him deeply, inside and out, to know him like no one else does. So what we're really talking about here is intimacy. Sex is more than just body parts joining. It's intended to be fundamentally a deep knowing, an intimacy in which you feel both seen and wanted. In real sex, you're naked, not just physically, but metaphorically. The masks come down, and you're connected in ways that are personal and amazing. It is life-giving to both of you. One study showed more than just sexual factors that lead to sexual satisfaction, and emotional intimacy as well. Having fun together outside of sex, sharing decision-making, trust, and marital quality all contributed to sexual satisfaction. A great marriage feeds a great sex life, but sex on its own can't create a great marriage. Another study found that 1/6 of women said their primary emotion after having sex was feeling used, that they would actually feel closer if they never had sex. Ouch. Great sex must involve connection, not frequency, not a variety of positions, not role play, The key to great sex is not being hotter, but being closer. Porn is one of the biggest roadblocks to intimacy. Often it is used as a poor way to self-soothe or regulate stress. When someone feels insecure, angry, stressed, lonely, or ashamed, it's easier to turn to porn to numb those feelings than to deal with the real cause of those feelings. This then typically causes more shame, more insecurity, more stress, and the cycle starts all over again. But quitting porn doesn't mean putting responsibility on your spouse for sexual release. That's not quitting porn and creating intimacy. That's clinging to the same unhealthy view of sex as a way to get what you want by using your spouse. That's not intimacy. Fantasy only brings release, not intimacy. Let's look at another more subtle blocker to intimacy. A husband may say, "How do I get my wife to have more sex? I do the dishes, but she's still not interested." And some of you, by your laughter, will obviously see the problem right away. But even if it comes out worse than it is really intended, like, "I'm helping to fulfill one of her needs, why can't she help fulfill one of mine?" it ultimately misses the point. By the way, this type of logic always sounds better in your head than it does when it comes out. Maybe, maybe not, saying that from experience. The problem is that this makes sex transactional rather than about connection. Doing the dishes does not magically turn your spouse on. In fact, if the higher drive partner does this, it's likely to have the opposite effect. Nobody wants to feel that sex is the payment for keeping up your part of keeping the household running. And wives can always tell when that's what's being done, when it's being done for payment rather than when it's done for being a good partner in the relationship. When you do life together, including and especially the mundane parts, when you care for each other, when you serve each other, desire tends to follow. This can be either naive or intentional and still have the same effect. I'm going to share some of my baggage here, but I beg you not to throw bananas at me. And if you know me, you know that's why that would be horrible. I share this because maybe others can relate, and this will help spark confession, reconciliation, and a way to move forward in a healthier manner. I think objectively, I came at this both intentionally and naively. Christy told you that we got married in college. The engineering program at OC was incredibly difficult. An 18-hour day was not uncommon between class and homework, class project. And on top of being in band and driving to OU for ROTC. She would come in from her job and cook dinner, and I would sweep in, scarf it down, and head back immediately to the engineering building for several more hours of work, leaving her to clean up dinner. I mean, what could I do? It was so much homework to be done, and I needed to get it done as quickly as possible so I could get home and get some sleep. And then there was that semester that we were in Christian Family, and we were being told, "Hey, you need to be having sex too, so, you know, get home and have sex." And so we were encouraged to make it a priority several times a week. When I got into the military, I admittedly and unashamedly wanted to get promoted as high as I could go, and I would do whatever it took. I wanted to provide for my family with a nice life and a good retirement so that my wife and kids would be set up well and have good opportunities. I was an achiever and a perfectionist, and a deep down part of me wanted the recognition of being a senior officer. A general, if I could. General Schwamm sounds really good. I had my career path all laid out. The gates I would have to hit, the better assignments that would give me a higher chance of getting selected for those opportunities that provided an even higher chance of promotion than I would have otherwise. I knew that would require lots of hard work and time, but it'd be worth it to provide that retirement and status to my family, whatever it took. And so I did it. That meant that I needed Christy to handle all the household stuff and the kids. After all, she was a stay-at-home mom. She had her domain, and I had mine. We've got our responsibilities and lanes in the road defined. And to Christy's credit, she supported me. Now I wonder why. Along about 2014, when I deployed to Afghanistan for a year, though, I started wondering whether I really did have the right sight picture. Hardest year of my career. I wondered if I had left my family in the dust while I pursued something that was finally beginning to, I was beginning to realize was going to take way more work and luck than I wanted to admit. Warren continuously trying to die on us, and Brennan having his moments too, also helped. I started to make family more of a priority. And if I had really stopped to look back at it objectively, I could tell you that we weren't caring for each other. We weren't serving each other. I was doing my thing, and she was doing what needed to be done. We really weren't having any fun together. The walls went up and there was no intimacy. I loved her madly. Despite me walking on eggshells all the time and us rarely having sex. And she put up with me. We were committed to each other, but we had created an intimacy problem that neither of us understood or knew how to solve. Now, I finally learned that we both had our issues and didn't have the tools to communicate and work through them. But with God's amazing work and a great therapist and a lot of effort on our part, we've made it to a much better place. And that's what I want to share with you in this class.
So let's talk about intimacy and how we create it. First of all, I want to bring you back to the thought we shared earlier, that intimacy between two people is a deep knowing of each other, a deep connection that brings joy and love between you, that drives you to take care of each other, to serve each other, and to trust each other. It turns out that there are two types of people, though. I alluded to this a few minutes ago. The type that needs to feel emotionally connected to have sex, and the type that needs to have sex to feel emotionally connected. And they usually marry each other. Therein lies the problem. If sex is what brings one partner closer than they've ever felt, and perhaps is the best way they know how to express the extent of their love for their spouse, and the other just can't fathom having sex if they don't feel connected to their spouse, then we're at an impasse. Vanessa Moran, the well-known sex therapist from the book earlier, says that in this case, emotionally intimacy wins. Both spouses should work together to create that emotional intimacy first, knowing that it's likely to lead to greater connection and higher desire. Generally, in a stereotypical marriage, the husband is the physical intimacy leads to emotional connection and the wife is the. But it is not that way all the time. And in this case, Vanessa says this even though she's the higher desire spouse and she likes physical intimacy first in her marriage.
And still says that emotional intimacy must come first. And I'm one of those too. So here's the reality though. It often doesn't feel safe or healthy to be physically intimate with someone when you're feeling disconnected from them. And if you're a survivor of sexual abuse, this kind of sex can even be triggering or re-traumatizing. But moreover, even for physical intimacy first people, the sex often feels like there's something missing. And I'll tell you now, after lots of communication, focusing on us and building connection between us, I've almost come to desire that emotional connection myself before sex. Almost.
So how do we build that intimacy? Many of the topics we're going to be talking about later in this class are going to cover these. But let me tell you about a few very quickly. First of all, make sure you're partnering on those big rock surviving issues that I talked about a few weeks ago. If one partner is so focused on surviving while the other is trying to work on living, that mismatch will breed frustration, distance, and a lack of trust. There's also a concept of mental load that we'll hopefully talk about in a few weeks. Mental load is, just a brief summary, is the amount of brain power someone has to exert to make sure that all the balls stay up in the air when you're juggling them and hit the floor. Many of those are surviving issues, like what we're going to eat for dinner, keeping the house clean, how we're going to parent, how we're going to keep little Johnny from destroying the house, and on and on. In general, wives tend to handle more of the mental load than their husbands, and this was true in our marriage. Once we understood the concept of mental load, though, it opened the door for us to have a conversation about who was taking care of what and how to make it more equitable. When you know better, you do better. Another aspect of the mental load is to keep in mind that it's more than just the doing. There's the planning stage and the execution stage and the keeping track of everything. Hope to speak more about that in a future week, because several of us could talk for hours about that in here. When we learned talking about mental load was that both of us were taking responsibility for way more than we realized. And when we saw that, we could problem solve better, and it started to bring connection. Second, in that vein, we recommend problem solving. Collaborate on the day-to-day things and decisions needed to keep the household running. Whether to buy that new couch, what to have for dinner that works for your busy schedules, how to make time for date nights, etc. Make a commitment to seeing things from the other spouse's perspective. Even prefacing what would you say with something like, this might not come out right, so give me the benefit of the doubt while I wobble a little bit. Or, help me get us to a shared understanding of what I'm trying to say. Things like that will slowly begin to build trust. Make room for non-sexual touch and affection. Go on dates and talk about what's going on in your lives. Remind each other of the things you like about each other. Learn to fall in love with each other all over again. I could go on and on. The point here is, if you want to build emotional intimacy, you need to connect with each other. And that happens on a long-term level. Tim calls it the trust and liking each other. And on a short-term, in the moment way, like, do I feel close to him right now? So far today, we've talked about acknowledgement, having conversations about sex, even if it's hard, and intimacy. Next week, like we said, we're not going to have our regular class. It'll be, there's activities during class time in support of Mission Sunday. And then 2 Sundays from now, October 19th, we're going to be talking about pleasure, mutuality, and desire. I promise, it'll be another week of things you never thought you'd be hearing someone talk about in church.